Welcome to Elevate Today Podcast. I am happy to be here starting a new series on Elevate Today Podcast. I took a little break, but I'm going to be coming back, coming in strong with a very special guest. Guys, today I have Tony. Tony, thank you for being here today.
You're welcome.
So I actually met Tony on a missions trip. He was my driver, and that was the very first time we met. We had a whole 7-hour drive, maybe more, of stories and talking and learning that this guy does a lot for his community. He gives with his whole heart. He loves with his whole heart. And you wouldn't think that just his heart, his character would bring about your life, your story that you've come upon. Like, you've gone through so much to be who you are. And I just want to honor you and give you the space to share your story so that you can continue to create the impact that you're creating, because you've impacted my life as well as everyone else on the team and everyone that you speak to. You have this ability to speak light into people's lives. So we're going to go into a conversation about Tony's life and learn about how you became to how you are now. So let's start by you just going into how you were raised.
All right. The way I was raised, it was kind of a harsh upbringing. My parents were young. My mom was 16 when she had me. My dad was 18, and it was rough. I was born on the day John F. Kennedy was assassinated. In fact, I was sort of named after him because my mom, when she was coming out of the anesthesiology, she just heard John F. Kennedy died. So I had his name for a little bit.
Oh, wow.
But, you know, birthdays were, for me, not good, so to speak, in that when you watch TV, everybody was mourning this president's death, and it was kind of hard to get that. So that's like the very beginning. And from there, you know, I had a dad who was pretty harsh. You know, he was one of those old-fashioned Mexicans, very strict, name-calling, believed in the belt. And my mom, she was just young. My dad used to cheat on my mom a lot. He would take us to places where he had a girlfriend and would threaten to hurt us if we told my mom what was happening.
How old are you at this point?
I was probably like 7-8 years old. Probably happened even earlier, but just the awareness.
Did you understand what cheating was at around that age?
I just probably knew it was wrong, because what he would do, like for me, I share the chocolate bars and chocolate, hot chocolate, have a totally different meaning and trigger, because the girl that he was seeing worked at a Winchell's donut place. Mm. So I knew that if he took us in and sat us at the table and brought us chocolate bars and chocolate, he was going out with the girl to the truck. Wow. Or if he told us to sit in the truck, brought us chocolate bars, and we would just sit in the truck for hours and hours. That was that experience. There's other things that I experienced that I look at that affected my life later, but you don't realize that it was. You know, I remember being held back in first grade, and that seemed to be an issue. The other thing was, is I was born here, but because my dad spoke Spanish, Spanish was my first language. So I had a hard time in school. And the other thing that I realized that I had to deal with especially with my dad, is I wet the bed. And he just like used it against me almost as if I did it on purpose, and would just shame me. And I would just feel horrible, like inside myself. Like I'm not doing this. I don't want to do this. And I'd been doing that, wetting the bed as a young age, probably until I was probably 11 or 12.
Is that a trauma response?
I've heard that could be.
I've heard that too.
You know, that it's stuff that's, you know, fighting, because my parents, they were young, and reality is they should have never got together. But you're talking back in early 60s where if a girl got pregnant, they got married. That's all there was to
family,
it.
Yeah.
And you have a family that has to deal with the shame. You know, as I got older, the other thing that I know really put me through a loop, when I was in fourth grade in elementary school, you know, we would make fun of the kids that were in special ed. You know, we'd call them retarded, stupid, you know, just name call, you know, just like kids do, just mean spirited. And then that summer in between fourth and fifth grade, I was put in that classroom. Everybody knew that classroom, Mr. McMillan's class. But I really didn't take it serious because it was summer school. I just thought I was being put in a class. Well, when first fifth grade started, guess what? I was put and stayed in that class. And
who decided that you were supposed to be in that class?
I don't know how that worked. You know, I just was there. I just learned you just don't ask questions.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's a culture thing of back then. You just don't ask. You just go with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was there, and that just is what I did. You know, I was there, and that was just a lot of shame. You know, so then I hit junior high. And to kind of go back at the same time, because this will have to be shared once I share later about what ended me in prison. At about the age of five, I had an uncle who was 2 years younger than me, and we would go to the Safeway, and he would have me steal candy bars. You know, we'd go in there and steal. I always think of Rocky Roads because that's what he wanted me to get. Rocky Roads.
5 years old.
Or we're stealing toys. And, you know, you kind of say uncle, but he was 2 years older than me, but you don't look at it. You just know he's your uncle. And there was stealing going on. You know, whether we go to a hobby shop, steal models, whatever we would get. So once I hit junior high, I was 12 years old, and I had my first experience with smoke marijuana with the friend Alex Weed Chopping, and that's how I started smoking weed and the people I was hanging around with. And then from there, oh, I recall another thing about a little younger, is that when I was about 10 or 11, I'm at an uncle's house, and I'm going to the bathroom, and I look to the left, it just happened that the bedroom door was open, and I see bags of cocaine or white drugs. I knew later that's what it was, and machine guns. And I had kind of known in my family that there's these little things going on with drugs, certain uncles, not all on my dad's, you know, these were on my dad's side. So I knew there was something there.
How old were you when you saw cocaine?
It was about 10 or 11.
And you had no idea what it was? You saw a white bag?
I never had no idea. I say cocaine, but I just knew it wasn't good. You know, there's just something that tells you, like, that's drugs.
Yeah.
And it could have been methamphetamine for all I know, but I just knew then, later, just it was had to have been cocaine. And, you know, the machine guns that they had there. And I knew they were machine guns, those round casings that they had, like those guns that they're like a magazine, but they're round. It's a round disc. And another, you know, other rifles that were there on the bed. So from there, we had a friend, you know, I was smoking marijuana, and I knew my other uncles were dabbling. I had heard one of my uncles was arrested in Stockton by undercover cops.
For weed?
For trying to sell drugs to undercover officer. But in that, there was a family friend that came up from Mexico. His name was Manuel, that they used my Uncle Luis's birth certificate to get him up here. And he was somebody that helped my great-grandmother in Mexico, which was a very poor place. It was dirt floors. So he came up, and I remember he was giving me the little sacks of cocaine and said that, you know, he got it from my Uncle Manuel. You know, I knew my Uncle Manuel was dealing. So a lot of this stuff that I would hear, you know, and I think later, you know, parents always tell you, that's not what you heard, that's not what happened. And I'm like, I know what I saw and I know what I heard, but then they're letting you know that it wasn't, you know. And the next time growing up in this life, especially when you could say criminal behavior or being exposed to criminal behavior, there was a time my Uncle Luis, that same one that turned me on to the stealing when I was a kid, we were taking a van to Mexico. This was a hollowed out van. And I kind of knew that what he had told me, it was supposed to be fixed up to be have drugs brought back in it. It was hollowed out. There was nothing in this van other than a spare tire. And when we were going up Pacheco Pass, he asked me if I wanted to smoke some PCP, which is angel dust and is not a good drug.
That one makes you like crazy, right?
Yes, it does.
Like energy, you feel powerful, you feel like you can break stuff.
Yeah.
Does the strength actually come? Do you actually get...
I don't think so. I just think it's the confidence. I'm not sure because this high was different for me. I just remember that he goes, well, let me hit it and then I'll tell you how to hit it, like how much. Mm-hmm. And I go, all right. And of course, I'm not going to listen to that. I was probably like 14 years old when this happened. So he hits it and he goes, just hit it like, just do that. Well, he passes it to me and I don't do that, just that. And I hit it stronger and I pass it back and boom. I knew there was something out of control because, you know, I've smoked weed and this was different. This high was totally different. I remember this Jeep that I was looking aside. I'm thinking nobody's driving it. And I'm telling him, I go, man, that there's nobody driving a Jeep. Nobody's driving. And I think, and he's telling me I'm tripping. And I tell him nobody's driving the Jeep. So, you know, when you're high like this, you're like thinking that, like there's nobody driving the Jeep. But you're high. Then I realize it's trivial as it sounds because I'm swearing up and down the Jeep was being pulled by a motorhome.
In your brain.
In my brain. It was being pulled, but when I saw the Jeep, I didn't see like the connection to the motorhome.
Oh, you know, I see. Yeah. Sounds it was funny. Just tied to the back.
It was just tied to the back of the motorhome being towed. But you know, when you have stuff like it kind of screws you up when you're high. And the other thing, too, doing that, this same uncle had also turned me on to LSD. He'd take me to what's called after-hour parties. And he would take me to King & Story. Back King & Story is on the east side of San Jose where lowriders and cholos would cruise and meet. And we'd party again, a lot of partying with him. And at the same time, I was also committing other crimes because I was already kind of in that flow. I mean, my friends, you know, I'd steal bikes, skateboards, go to the hobby store, steal from there, plus, you know, doing the drugs, smoking the weed, the cocaine, doing mushrooms, just the stuff that I was introduced.
All at 14?
Yeah, 14, but really it started at the age of 12 when Manuel gave, that family friend gave me the bags of cocaine and then smoking marijuana with my friend Alex in his fort. So I'm just living a life of crime. I see this stuff my uncle's doing, dealing, and then I'm not taking school serious, though I did like sports. You know, there's things that, you know, when I look at my life, this contradiction of I wanted to be a good person. You know, as I remember playing baseball when I was a little kid. I did, a walkathon to raise money. I knew there was something there, like to give back. It's not like I actually thought that I want to be a criminal.
Yeah.
Like I want to be a bad guy. It was just these little dabbles that I justified. I'm just dabbling in this life of crime. I only do it or nobody's getting hurt. Or nobody's going to miss it, you know, just justifying the crimes that I committed and the stealing. But what I realize, you know, kind of where I'm at, you know, I'll be fast forwarding is that how that progressed, you know, where here I am 5 years old, stealing Rocky Roads and little models. Next thing you know it, I'm stealing a moped. I'm stealing a car. I'm rolling a dirt bike away and taking it to my house.
Yeah.
And all this time, and just like the drugs, whether it's the first couple of puffs of marijuana, then it was this coke, and then it was somebody offers you a pill and then you don't even ask what it is. And even that same person that's giving you a pill saying, man, why are you going to ask me? You already took it. You know, things like that. That's how crazy my life got. And at the same time, when I was about 14, 15, my parents are separating, getting a divorce. And that was pretty vicious. They and I knew it was more on my dad's part. It's because he didn't want to pay child support. So he was trying to get us to live with him so he doesn't pay my mom. He had me do some things that, you know, I'm not proud of. I was probably, I want to say 14 or 15. He had paid me and my friend, I don't know, it was like $10. And he showed me how to throw a rock through the sliding glass door at her house and break the glass. And the plan was that he was going to accuse my mom that it was a boyfriend of hers. And it wasn't. And the one thing I never knew, I never saw my mom with another man or never. It was just all from my dad. You know, there was a time in the garage, he had this tool that's like an awl. It's like an ice pick. And I remember being in the garage and he had a hammer and he poked the bottom of the car and he says, we're going to tell your mom that her boyfriend shot at her with a gun. So there was things that, you know.
So you were older now, though.
Yeah, I'm older, like 15 years old.
Did you throw the rock at her window?
Yes.
And how was your consciousness, your conscience? Did you just feel so loyal to your dad, or you just kind of knew that this is how he was as a father? So part of you looked up to that and liked it?
Yeah, it seemed like that was the thing to do.
You trust your father.
You know, you trust. And it's interesting, you know, when you ask that, because once I get to how I ended up in prison, the psychologist asked me, what do you know about consequences? You know, like understanding. And I told him, of course, then I could explain when I was taught, but I didn't think of that. I didn't have no concept of it. Just, I was just, like you said, I was just doing the loyal thing to my dad. Mm-hmm. Plus he was giving me money. So I kind of just did what he said, like thinking it was right, but it wasn't right. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of things that happened in my childhood that, you know, the crimes kept on, I did a burglary when I was 18 years old. But when I was 17, well, I dropped out of school when I was a freshman year, and my freshman year and sophomore year, I just didn't think school was cool. I didn't think I needed
school. And by that point of your life, your parents had no authority over you with a divorce?
Not really. I mean, they were so fighting. I think my mom tapped out, like, to fight.
Yeah.
You know, and I could probably understand. I don't know what it was. Maybe she felt a betrayal, you know, of us. Because I know it comes up later. You know, my mom will say things to me, even as an adult. You know, she could tell me something 6 months ago, like something I did when I was 15. Yeah. Mom's still around. Dad's still around.
Do you talk to your dad?
Yeah, we still talk. I learned through my walk now when I was in prison to forgive him, you know, for what he did. Because when I was in there, I wanted my kids to understand and forgive me. And they should understand. And please let God let them understand so I could be in their life. And God basically said, which at the time I didn't know it was God. But he said, well, how do you want your kids to forgive you if you can't forgive your parents? So that's how I had to learn about forgiveness. You know, is that I had to forgive my dad, because how do I want forgiveness for the stuff I did, for leaving my kids and abandoning them with the mom, you know, when I went to prison? But, you know, I'm still trying to do the right thing at this age, about 17. And I had older friends that were joining the Marines. Wow. And I told myself, I want to be a Marine. I want to serve my country. You know, I always had this thing, again, the good guy. Like, my head's telling me, I know I'm a good guy. I want to defend my country because of other family members that either joined or my family had friends that were in the Vietnam War, that you just feel that's just your duty. You serve your country. And I took the test and didn't do too good with the Marines, the test that they give you. I only scored enough to get into the National Guard. I joined the National Guard, went through basic training, and that was reservist. National Guard was a reservist unit. And I know this was a pivotal spot in my life, because when I got back, you know, I had my certificate, United States Army, and it was basically sheet metal worker, but it was welding. And I'm thinking, man, I got my military ID. I got this United States Army. I'm in, and like, doors are going to open. That's what my mentality was. And the first place I went to, it was over here, it's by here on Coleman. It was called FMC, and it's by the airport, and they built the Bradley tanks, and they needed welders. And I went there, and they told me, oh, we need journeyman experience. And I had no clue what journeyman meant.
Yeah.
I just did it. You know, I would look at the newspapers, and I'd see, you know, for jobs like welder, shut off.
Oh, it's still on.
Oh, okay. Oh, sorry.
Good catch. Good catch.
Allegedly. And, you know, I would go there, and they would tell me, oh, we need you to be a journeyman or get into an apprentice program.
Journeyman is like someone who's already done it, right?
You've done it, but you have the years. Like, it has to do with the experience.
Okay.
Like, from your vocation when you take it, then they want like a journeyman where I'm guessing the jobs aren't as, you know, big or something, that you're building the experience for another higher level of experience to be working on tanks. That's what I think a way easy way to put it.
Okay.
Is in that way. And I would go to this spot, and I go, you know, you need this. And the one thing I remember, my dad said, I'll get you a job. And my dad was a garbage man. And at the, you know, growing up, garbage men got teased, you know, like, that's a dirty job, they're stupid and things like that. So I was never proud of my dad's job. There's no reason to, but that's just what you get from school.
Yeah,
they tease you about that. And I say that because I couldn't find a job. So he had a friend, I still remember his name is John, and he had this very small garbage company. And my job there was to weld the casters on the and repair the dumpsters. And I just, for me, the way my head was working, that's just like I took steps down. You know, I felt I should be working at FMC or a higher place because I had that expectation, that green card. That was my ticket. It was United States Army, that green card and that certificate. And that was just something that it was hard to deal with, being there, smelly dumpsters with trash in it, fixing these tires. And, you know, from that, I think somewhere it happened. And maybe I've never really looked into the ongoings, even though I've done recovery into that episode. But with that bitterness and anger that I didn't know I was bitter and angry, me and my friend were driving around, and we went by a Montgomery Ward's, and we did a smash and grab. You know, we were still, it was a Grand Auto place or Montgomery Ward's, and I threw a brick through a window and took some fog lights and a sunroof and kept on doing it. Long and the short, we got caught because we went back too many times. Well, he got caught. I didn't, but they were taking my car because we were in my car. So I kind of pretend like, hey, that's my car. What's it doing here? Ooh. Well, the cops, they weren't going for that. They arrested me.
Did you get time?
Yeah, I took a deal for 90 days, you know, in the county jail. I was only in the county jail here at Elmwood for 2 weeks. And what I did was, is I got on this, they call it PSP program, public community something, where you pick up trash. So that's how I did the remainder of the time.
Did anyone ever tell you that you could go to jail that easily at 17?
Nah, because you're kind of cocky. Because you've gotten, see, I hate to say it, but I've gotten away with a lot of crimes. So you build this, I'm good.
Yes. And then like you were talking about, it's the addiction it's, of, even the adrenaline of getting caught might be there too.
Yeah, but you just think you have this master, like you're this top criminal. Mm. You know, my goals were twisted. I mean, I think when you asked that question, I remember thinking, oh man, the ultimate goal job, like not to be a doctor, not to be a lawyer was like, man, I want to rob a jewelry store. I'm going to break into a jewelry store. Like that's twisted, but my brain was just kind of in and out thinking that. So as that time happened with the age of 18, 19, then I started doing crank every now and then, methamphetamine.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's what we called it.
Crank is meth.
Yeah, meth. Yeah, okay. Crank, that's the, there's other kind of words I can't remember, but it was speed or crank. I started doing that. I had the boss that I worked for, he dealt in it. He had his own company, but he was also dealing it too because he had friends that cooked it and he would supposedly get the good stuff. I kind of crack up on that word good stuff. You know, when they say, oh, it's a good crank. And I go, you mean the stuff that's not going to land you in jail and, you know, lose your teeth and nothing like that. And I started, you know, I started doing it, but not that serious. It really, I mean, I would do it, but I didn't get into it. And again, you know, the other thing was I had a girlfriend. I got her pregnant, so I had a son. When I was, what, like 19 or 20. This was in 1984. And I started working at a artisan's, a furniture place. I think I was probably, maybe got this job when I was 20 years old. So this had to have been, well, like 84, 85 or so. And was working there as a furniture place. And I painted furniture because I told them that I know how to paint because that's what I learned in the Army. It really was, and I lied. I mean, they taught us with the little can, but I didn't know. I just, yeah, I could paint. I could do this. I got the job in the painting department, and this guy, George, who was the lead guy in the booth, was telling me, hey, we got to speed it up. They want us to do about 30 quarts a day. You know, these 30 cans of spraying this furniture. And he was like, I got some death crank in the back. We could speed up. I'm like, death crank? And it's like, all right. He goes, I'll hook you up with the line. And go to the back of the booth, do a line. Because I never really done the crank at before I did it, but not so much. It was kind of just off and on. And I just didn't do it that much. For whatever reason, I didn't have that. The taste for to want to do it. It was there, whether every 3 months, whatever it was, I didn't do it much.
What does it make you feel?
You get speeded up. I mean, you just feel big. But this is what's going to go with what I'm going to say next. So I'm glad you asked that. So I do the crank. I can't sleep that night. And I go in and I'm like, George, man, I'm like, I didn't sleep, man. I'm feeling like I was just staring at the ceiling in bed. And he's, oh, well, I'll get you a bag. And he goes, I'll get you an eighth. I'll front it to you. Pay the guy on Thursday. So he gets me a bag doing it. So again, that's that kind of that cycle doing, you know, crank. Well, getting to the how it makes you feel, because I really didn't realize how it made me feel. I just knew it made me speed up. But what happened was, and I had heard this before, that a lot of addictions start for one reason and then continue for another. Well, in this, I turned on my girlfriend to some crank. And that took on a whole nother life itself, because when we were together intimately, it just, the euphoria of being in that kind of that sexual relationship, what she did, like things that she wouldn't, I'm not, sounds crazy, but things that she was more shy not to do when she was straight or me, it took on a whole nother level. And back then, I mean, kind of being serious, but I would tell her, yeah, we're going to have porn sex. You know, that's the mentality, because, and she liked it. I mean, it was, we both enjoyed it. We, you know, and that crazy thing is at the same time I had a girlfriend, she was kind of at the time my side piece. And, you know, we go to a motel for a few hours or go here and we're high and I just enjoyed it, you know, doing the crank. So I'm at this job, you know, this is all going on. I got the wife. I think I was married by that time, but I'm just repeating what I learned in that, kind of like you have the wife, the girlfriend, and the side piece.
Just like your dad.
Just like my dad, saw my uncles do it. And not just me, and I'm not just bagging on my family. I mean, I had friends that they had the same kind of situation.
Well, that, understand that it's culturally normalized, and now that's respectable terms that I have to have a term for.
Oh,
it's not cheating and having a girlfriend anymore. It's just...
Yeah, it's just...
A modern society.
Yeah, it's... What else do you do? You're just... You're being you. I never felt guilty because... The other thing was, is I had a child with my wife's sister, you know, and so there's another little girl. She's not a little girl. They're 38 or 39 because we messed around. I messed around with her sister. She got pregnant. And
she never thought about aborting, or that wasn't a thing?
No, it wasn't nothing. It was just going full throttle. She was young. She was... I think 16 or 17 at the time, and
that's devastating.
19.
Did you guys get a divorce?
Well, crazy thing is with me and my wife, because I ended up getting arrested, we didn't get divorced till like 2000. You know, I was still married to my wife, but she didn't want to get married. One, it was money thing. I'm in prison. How do you do it? And she had this thing. She would say, well, I'm not going to divorce you because I don't know if you're going to inherit money or win the lottery. So she wanted to get her money.
Never heard that before.
But that's what her reason was. And she had a kid from another guy in 94. So I would tell her, I mean, it was easier for her to do it. And I would, you know, when we were on some talking terms to do it. And it just, you know, that's that part. So now getting a little ahead, I'm at this shop and there's a guy, it's kind of odd how this even happened. And to this day, whether spirit, however you want to call it, how this happened, and it's still a mystery. There was a guy, Rick, at this furniture shop that he always kept to himself. He never talked to anyone. He just did his own thing. And I say that because it was a tradition at this job that, you know, kind of a core group of this company. I don't know. There could have been 60 people working at this furniture place, but there was like about a kind of a core group, about 10 of us that would go to this store down the street and cash our checks and have some beers. You know, at this little neighborhood bar, you know, the grocery store, cash our checks and go out one door, go into this bar and have our beers and go on our merry way, stay there until whatever length. So this, I know it when it had to have happened. It happened in March of 85 because I got arrested in 86. So this one time, Rick decides to go to that bar. And, you know, we're there, we're talking, and I have to go. So he asked me, he goes, how do you get home? I go, well, I take the express bus. So this is in Santa Clara. It's just around the corner from this place.
Oh, yeah.
Just down the street on San Martin. There used to be the dog pound there. It's not there no more. But the furniture place is funny. It's not that furniture place, but I just saw it. There's a furniture place there, but not the same company. So I tell him I know how to get home because we lived over there in South San Jose. He lived more by like Monterey and Bernal or Branham. and I was more on Blossom Hill and Snell. So I told him, we'll just take the bus. So we're taking the bus, and for whatever reason, this guy never wanted to hang out, never really talked to me. Like, we spoke.
Yeah.
He says, hey, let's stop at this place, at this bar. And I'll say the name of Sam's Bar. It doesn't exist anymore. And I go, all right. Well, he goes, we'll have a couple more beers just to chill. So we go in the bar. He knows I have crank because I was dealing in a little bit of crank. I try to sell to then buy what I'm using, kind of thing. I wasn't a dealer. You call me a dealer, but it was more just to
pay your portion,
pay my portion, kind of double it, and just so I could at least get back what I'm using and then buy some more. So I give him the bag. He goes to the bathroom, gives it to me. I go to the bathroom. I come back, and he's talking to this girl, and her name is Sandra. And we're at the bar, and he tells me, he said, I got to go now. My uncle's going to pick me up, but you guys have a good time or do whatever. So we're at the bar and talking, and then she tells me something about some guy across the bar that she doesn't want to be there. Whatever it was, I don't know what it was that she didn't want to be at the bar, that she wanted to leave. So I told her, hey, I got some crank. Do you do crank? And she goes, oh, I do. And I got it. She told me she had a joint. She said, well, we'll go to the car. So we go to her car because, I'm on the bus. We go to her car and I ask her, do you still want to like party or do whatever? We could go to the Saddle Rack. The Saddle Rack used to be in San Jose off of over there by like Ray Street and Meridian. Then it moved to Fremont, but there used to be Saddle Rack downtown. So we went there, partied there, and then it was time to go. And all this time, we're doing, when we're getting friendly, kind of like if we're together. And it's the craziest thing, because I was thinking like we're making plans, like we're going to see each other the next day, like we're going to go out.
Yeah.
And I'm married. The crazy thing is I'm married, but I'm just like, it's natural for me to then have another whatever, just to have, whether bragging rights. My friends, when we were in high school, we would say that just bragging rights. Like, oh, one more for the scoreboard. Hmm. That was the thing me and my friends would say. It was always a scoreboard. Girls at high school, oh, another one for the scoreboard. So she takes me home. And I ask her, would you want to come up? And I ask, she comes up, and I don't know if you want to know, this is more detail, so we're just going to be
whatever you want, if you feel raw. Comfortable.
Well, I have to, like I told you. It's just giving back. Because I took something that I shouldn't never have. And if I could stop somebody else from doing it, because it could lead down that road. Because it led down the road for me.
Yeah.
So I invite her up and I told her she had to be quiet going up the steps. She's my mom and my stepdad were there and it was late. They're in their bedroom. And the reason why I wanted her to be quiet was because I was staying at my mom's house. And she always said, I don't want any girls in this house because I don't run a whorehouse. So don't be bringing your women to the house. This is not a whorehouse. And so I knew that rule, it's just, I don't bring women over. And so she comes up and we start messing around. She asked me what time it is. And I told her, she goes, oh, I got to get home. It's late. And I'm like, we're jacked up on crank. She sits up. I'm holding her and just trying to like maybe get her back in the mood so we could have sex. That feeling's there. I'm cranked up. I've been cranked up for days. It never stopped. Because by this time, I've been using way much more crank daily than I was before. Now it just, it was a part of life.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just using crank all the time, smoking weed, drinking all the time. And I start holding her, and she passed out on the bed. And I'm like, oh, shit. And I lay her down, and I'm like, what just happened? And I'm just starting to panic now. So then I put my hand on her. I put my hand on her mouth so she doesn't scream or make a noise, because I'm like, what do I do? You know, and the thing is, what I learned about meth, that you could get paranoid pretty quick. Things that you start imagining what's going to happen. And I go, she's going to accuse me of this. She's going to accuse me of that. But nothing happened. And when I look down, I see blood coming on the side of her nose. And I don't know how to take that, because I know I didn't hit her. I just put my hand on her nose, on her mouth.
Yeah.
And her nose is exposed. It's not like I'm preventing her from stop breathing. None of that. But the blood, just seeing the blood, something happened to me that I panicked. And I strangled her. And from that, I got her stuff and dumped her body in a field that was across the street from my mom's house. And I did that. And I remember the next day, this one friend, Walter, because we were trying to kind of sell methamphetamine. And I told him what happened. I go, Walter, man, I went too far. And I told him what I did. And he goes, well, just be careful. Don't do that stuff again. Just, nobody's going to know. But I told him, she's in that field right there. About a month later, I come home and the weeds are cut in that field. And I'm like looking for, like, I'm panicked, looking for the cops. And I'm looking around and I'm just tripping in my head, just tripping bad. While at the same time, my brother is living with my mom too. He ended up living there, you know, he was there. And so this is getting to me. I mean, like I said, I knew this happened, but just trying not to do the things to get myself in that situation and trying to become a better person. But it just was, I was already just out of it, whatever was going on. So the month later, when I saw that field, me and my brother are upstairs in the room smoking weed. And I told them, I go, man, I killed this girl and I dumped her body in the field. And that was it. And then about 2 months later from when I did the crime, I'm living somewhere else and my TV's on and I hear the news that a body was found on Blossom Hill Road. And I wake up and it's that field. And I don't want to go around my mom's house. I'm thinking the cops are going to be there. So nothing ever happened. So this is I know that the crime happened in March. And 2 months later, so that brings me to May of 85.
Wow.
So months go by.
Those months, like, you were on crank the whole time. You don't really remember him. It was a fade.
It's just living the life. It's like you're in denial. Like, whatever you do, don't get caught. You're okay. Just don't put yourself in that position again.
Yeah.
Don't put yourself in that spot again. Because when you're in that mindset, you still think you got it under control. Mm. Like, it's always this, as long as I don't do this, as long as I don't do that, as long as I don't go here, so it's all this BS. But you could still get caught up in other things.
Mm-hmm.
Other things happen, other people you hang with that are kind of influences that create a trigger in you that you're going to go back out there and do something stupid. So this is the following year. It was 86 now. And I believe it was probably around March. I'm at my grandmother's house and my grandmother says, hey, your grandfather's looking for you. He said he has a card for you that some investigators looking for you about somebody missing. And I'm like, who can that? But of course, my head is thinking the girl. I'm like, but it can't be, because I'm thinking time. I mean, how is that possible? And so my I get the card from my grandfather, and it just happened that I'm at my boss's house. I went to Nick's house where I was working at, and he told me, hey, your mom was by here looking for you. So she wants you to call her. So I call my mom, and she says, Tony, we got to talk. And I'm like, and of course, I'm playing dumb.
Yeah.
All this, I'm trying to, like, play dumb in this. And she's saying, your brother's accusing you of killing somebody. And I'm like, he says something about a friend of his, that he's not going to let his friend go to jail because he, you know, killed somebody, you know, because of what I did. And I'm like, well, I don't know. I can't remember. I was drunk, and I just remember some guy was there. So I kind of was starting to make my own narrative of, you know, I told you we were at that bar, and she said, there's this guy. I just kind of put that, like, oh, I could use that story, like, this guy. And I didn't know what guy they were talking about. So she says, we got to talk. Are you going to be there? And I said, well, okay, I'll wait for you. I took off. You know, and I could see her. I was in the car, and I could see her go to Nick's house. And I just couldn't deal with it anymore. I just was having a hard time. I just knew I had to kill myself. So I just had to figure out how I was going to kill myself and what way. So I started thinking about it. So I remember stealing a big bottle of aspirin, and I wrote two suicide letters. And then I'm thinking, well, maybe I could use the exhaust from my car and I just get a hose. I just didn't know, right? And so I wrote the letters. I ended up going to where my wife was staying at with her parents. I start drinking the aspirins in the evening. I'm laying in the side of the house where this field is at. I end up waking up. I thought I was heaven because the grass was shiny. You know, the sun was beaming on it, but I wasn't. Started throwing up the aspirin, and I go up to my wife, the house, knocking on the door, and she says, where have you been at? Your mom has been calling, trying to get a hold of you. Where you been at? And I'm just throwing up. So she calls my mom. She goes, I don't know what's wrong with Tony. He doesn't stop throwing up. So my mom gets there, picks me up, takes me to the drugstore, gets some mail locked. She says, you cannot go to the hospital, because if you go to the hospital and you tell him you try to commit suicide, you're going to be labeled as somebody that's crazy. And you don't need that label. So do you think you could go to the hospital? Do you think you need to go to the hospital? I says, okay, we won't go to the hospital. She goes, you can't go to the hospital. You can. The whole time I'm throwing up. So she takes me to the park, Cunningham Park, and is telling me this, your brother's accusing that you killed somebody and that his friend is in jail fighting a murder charge. Something about a friend, that he's going to stick up for his friend, and they paid him, and he's going to testify against you to get his friend off the case, so he could beat the case. And she says, well, what happened? She goes, you know you're going to go to prison, so we got to think of a plan. You're going to have to leave the country. So my mom and my stepdad was from Costa Rica, says, okay, you're going to have to go to Costa Rica. Carlos has an uncle there that's like the general, the military guard. And since you have that experience in the National Guard, maybe you could fit in and change your name. But we'll buy you a ticket, buy you clothes. We went to JCPenney's. And she bought me a ticket for Florida. And the plan was go to Florida, get a merchant ship, then go to Costa Rica. That was the plan. But I was just, and she says, you can never, ever call Darlene. You got to forget about your life. The life you have here is dead, no longer exists. Darlene doesn't exist anymore. We do not exist to you anymore. Your life is gone. You have to make a new life. Because if you come back, you're going to prison, and Darlene will never let you see the kids. So that's your choice. So I'm taking the bus. This is somewhere in March. And I'm just freaking out. And I hit L.A., the Los Angeles, because it stops. The buses always stop. And I'm thinking somebody's looking for, oh, because I did talk to the investigator that day. You know, and I told you before the suicide thing, I did talk to the investigator for the defense attorney, that guy's attorney. I forgot about that. So he gave me the subpoena to appear in court the next day to testify. And that's what I told my mom. You know, she goes, well, you can't testify. You got to go. So I did have a subpoena. That was, I forgot that part.
What is a subpoena?
It's basically a court order that comes from a judge that you have to appear in court as a witness. And
by the way, we're going to do a part two because we got about 20 minutes on the cameras.
Oh, 20. Okay. And so I'm down in LA at the bus station there. And I decide, you know what, I don't know what to do. I can't. I'm just going to go to Ensenada. We have family there. My dad's from there. And I knew kind of, I could hook up with the cousin. I just didn't, I couldn't imagine, you know, Florida. And it was safer for me to go there. So I go to Ensenada. And I really don't want to contact any of my cousins or my aunt to go to the house. I just had to think, and I still was on the suicide thing. So I went to they sell, because it's a tourist town, and they, for some reason they always sell bull whips. So I went to one of them. I bought a long bull whip and a bottle of tequila. I believe it was tequila. I went back to the hotel. The plan was I was going to commit, hang myself, but I got too drunk. And I didn't, you know, I just didn't go through with it. And a week had passed. And the whole time I'm just like, man, I miss the family. You know, I can't, like my mom said, if that tape is playing, your family's gone. Your son doesn't exist anymore. Darlene doesn't exist anymore. And so I go to my cousin, finally went to my cousin's house and kind of explained to him what happened. And he's like, okay, well, you could stay here. Just, you know, live your life here and I'll help you out. But I was getting stuck. He wanted to smoke weed and drink. And
you made it to Mexico?
Yeah, I made it to Ensenada. I changed the ticket to go to San Isidro, which is the last town. It stopped right at the border. Then I took a taxi to the bus station in TJ, bought a ticket there, and then took the bus to Ensenada. That's how I ended up doing that.
Oh, my gosh.
So I'm there, and the bad thing, you know, when I smoke weed is I get on a whole nother trip. Like, I was hard timing, right? I started, you know how it gets to you more.
Yeah.
And my mom said, don't call. Don't call, darling. Whatever you do. I could just think that right in my head. Well, I called, and my wife is telling me, where are you at? The police are looking for you. They just want to talk to you. That's all they do. They understand. They just want to talk to you. And where are you at? And I told her, I go, I'm here. And she goes, well, just come. You got us. You got Tony. You got Angela. You got me. They just want to talk to you. That's it. They understand. But in my own head, I know I did the crime by myself. I have no clue about this other guy whatsoever. This guy, his name is Tom Snyder, which was my brother, had worked for his brother around our family's house. It was like they did detailing, you know, and that's how that came about. So I get back home. I just decide, you know what, I'm going to come. I go to the house, we call the police, the detective of the car, and he goes, oh yeah, just come for an interview. And we just want to talk to you, it's all right. And I'm in there, and I talk to him, and I'm doing the whole thing. I'm playing dumb thing, right? I'm just playing stupid. Like, oh, this guy was drunk. I can't remember. And he was there. And then my dad's telling this other crazy story. My dad kind of got involved, and he told a story that wasn't even true, but he made up a story to try to get me off, which made it worse. You know, that, oh, we were in an apartment. It was five guys, and Tom Snyder was holding her down and having sex with her, and Tony was in the bed, which never happened, right? It's just my dad kind of picked up pieces thinking he was going to help me. So real quick before I get, because of the courts, to kind of keep track.
Yeah.
What happened was thing with Tom Snyder and my brother, how that came about. Apparently my brother was walking down the street in San Jose, and that guy's brother saw my brother, like he recognized him. And they were talking. Oh, he saw him. They were talking like what's going on. He goes, hey, so how's your brother Tom Snyder doing? He goes, oh man, he's fighting a hot one right now. A hot one means
a murder case,
a bad case. And that was it. You know, they talked. And then somehow within a week later, this is all in March, a week later, my brother runs into the same guy at a liquor store. The reason I know all this is because the police reports. See, they give you discovery. The district attorney has, whenever you hear discovery, when they have to exchange who they have witnesses, the DA has to give everything they have that's taking you to trial. So my brother sees his brother at the liquor store. He goes, hey, why don't you come over? And he goes, oh, where do you live, Ron? I go, oh. My brother tells him. He says, oh my God, I just live right around the corner. Why don't you come over? And so my brother comes over. They're getting high. And my brother asked this guy again, hey, so what's going on with your brother in this thing? He goes, oh man, he got arrested for this, this, and this. And he goes, my brother told me a story like that too. So this guy then goes to his brother's attorneys and say, this guy Rawl told me that his brother had confessed to him about this case, where they found the body, so they put it together. That's how the connection happened. And the reason this guy was on the radar, Tom Snyder, was he was supposed to meet Sandra at that bar. She was messing around with him. And apparently she was married. She had a husband she lived in a trailer park, had two kids, but she had another life that she was living, wow. Right? And I knew this because, again, from the police reports, when I was arrested, remember, I'm not arrested yet. So this kind of information I'm giving you has to kind of put the puzzle together.
Yeah.
Because they had interviewed girls there and guys, and it was kind of, I'm not making light of it, but they were like, oh, we're not surprised that happened to her because she kind of messed around like that. Apparently she had pissed somebody off. That guy that she was uncomfortable, he told her that she's going to be at Sands with this girl and that he was going to take her on that trip he had promised Sandra to go. He's going to take this girl. That's why she wanted to leave, was it was the guy that was kind of flaunting this other girl, supposedly,
wow.
But not Tom Snyder. So Tom Snyder ended up getting arrested because the cops... What had happened was, oh, okay, his name comes up there. The other reason his name really came up, when they found the body in the field, it just happened that Tom, his brother, another brother, or his cousin and a friend, happened to be driving by the field at the same time with the tape. So his brother,
wow.
Tom says...
There was a tape at the farm?
No, at the field. The cop tape. You know when the cops put yellow tape, crime scene tape? That you ever see that they'll put, like, if there's a crime, the police will put crime scene tape. So that means you can't enter. they'll put it like on the car. Mm-hmm. It's a barrier that you can't cross. So they stopped, got out. Well, the cops are going to be taking names. His name came up. Another time his name came up was at a, what was that restaurant? It was called the Monterey. It was a restaurant that doesn't exist on Monterey Road, like by Alma down, you know, and him and his friend are in a booth and he has the flyer of the missing person, which I'm on, and he's telling his friend, well, there's a waitress that is listening because she also knows about the case, because the people that would go to like the Saddle Rack or Sam's after they would close would go have eat there because that restaurant was open 24/7. So that crowd would always go there. So the waitress was familiar with that group of friends of people that would go there. So Tom was, I guess, in the way she explained, so let me know how much time I have.
Around 10 minutes.
Okay.
We'll do a part two for sure.
All right. So then Tom says, yeah, that's what she gets for fucking with me. She should never have messed around with me like that. Mm. There's always a cop there apparently at that restaurant. She was scared, so he waited. So she tells him what she heard and with the flyer. And then once they start doing the investigation, Tom Snyder and his brother's friend ran into some girls because they were in the police report too, and said, yeah, if you mess with us, you'll get what this chick had coming, what got. Like he was, but the thing was, he never did anything. Wow. So that made him
look guilty.
Look guilty as Get Out. That's why he, and mind you, he was on trial already. Before you go to trial, they call what's a preliminary hearing. A preliminary hearing is a DA presents to a judge a certain amount of evidence, a mini, mini trial, just to say, Your Honor, there's enough evidence to take this man to trial, to a jury trial.
Wow.
And they did.
Yeah.
So that's so you could kind of get the background. So now take you back where I go to the police department. You know, when I came back from Mexico, when I come back from the police, I'm in the police department. The room, their interview room, and I'm doing the whole thing, and I'm just like, I gotta get out of this. I just gotta get out. How do I get, you know, and I'm thinking I'm slick. At the same time, if I play it this way, I play it that way. I'm playing the game. You know, now it's a role. Now we're playing, I'm gonna get out of this because I know I can. So they said, well, you know, we're gonna take you to the court so you could testify and let us know. So I get there, and it's probably like 3 o'clock. It was a surprise how long I was in the interview room. Because I went in there like at 8 o'clock, and all of a sudden it's 3 o'clock. Mm-hmm. Like, what? I get on the stand, and the district attorney's asking me questions because they're the ones who had the subpoena on me. It wasn't the DA. So he's asking me these questions, and I'm doing the whole thing, the whole spiel. Man, it could be him. I don't know. I was drunk. You're talking something a year ago. I can't really remember this. And at the same time, at the stand, the judge is here. Here, there was this big aerial picture, right? And that was the one thing I forgot. I left out about the car. So they had this huge aerial picture of the neighborhood, Snell and like where 85 is at now in that whole area. And there's string, like lines, that Tony's house, victim found, and the car burnt. Because what it was, the car, nothing happened in the car, but I took the car to a church parking lot and I set it on fire so my fingerprints wouldn't be shown. That was the other thing. And
just gasoline and lit it.
Yeah, just lit it. I didn't. Well, not no gasoline was funny. I shouldn't say funny. There was just trash in the car, like just trash, like restaurant, just papers and whatever. So I just lit it on fire, and it lit itself on fire. I didn't have to do anything because there was already enough garbage inside the car. And So that was that. And what got me is he came out with my time cards. Mm. And all of a sudden, something in my head said, because he goes, okay, on this day you checked, you clocked in on, and this day you clocked in, on this day you clocked in, and why did you clock in on this day like this? And on, and then on a Friday when you never clocked in on, and I would tell him overtime. But in my head's going like, okay, pitcher, time cards, and this is going to not, I think, Perry Mason. I don't know if he, this is an old show, Perry Mason. It's an old attorney show that was in the 50s or 60s where he always ended up making the people confess and got the right person. Hmm. Because they'd always try to have the wrong person or whatever. So he'd always beat the case. So I'm thinking, oh my God. So I tell the judge, I go, Your Honor, I think I need an attorney. And he looks at me, goes, I think you do too. We're going to adjourn for now. So they get me a public defender. I told basically what happened. He goes, well, what you're going to do is plead the fifth. And they're going to keep on asking you, are you going to answer any? You just keep, and more than likely, they're going to put you in jail for contempt of court. And you just keep on doing it. And eventually, they're going to have to let you loose. Eventually, I don't know when, but you will. So they threw me in jail.
And the lawyer, your lawyer knew you did it.
Yeah, because I told him. I gave him enough to say I did it. He didn't do it. Mm. And what's crazy is in the paper, it did happen later. So I ended up getting out of jail 2 weeks later because the judge asked me. He goes, so as long as we hold you, you're not going to say anything. We could hold you for a year. I said, I'm not going to say anything. He goes, okay, well, I have no choice but to let you go. So they let me go free. I walked out. About a month later? Oh, then I found out there was a mistrial, like 7 not guilty and 4 whatever or 5 guilty on this other guy. And he didn't even do it. It was a mistrial.
That's wild.
Right? It was a mistrial. And the guy had nothing to do with it other than him bragging and what he said. And he was supposed to be here and he was here and said this and that. And so it was about a month later, walking out of the house, and Mary would always give my family the Mercury newspaper, the San Jose Mercury paper, but it would always be the front page. Of all times, she gives my wife, she would have normally handed it to me, but it was just in the position, because it was a tall old Victorian house. She hands, of all times, that she usually gives it to another family member, my grandfather, somebody at the house, of all times, she's giving the paper to my wife with the local section. I don't know if you're familiar with the San Jose Mercury, how they have sections. So your front page is usually like front worldly stuff. And then the second section of it is like San Jose news, things like that. Right there, the big caption. Man found mistrial, DA, and now DA is going to look at pressing charges on Anthony Orozco.
You got your name in the paper?
Got my name in the paper.
Before they could prove you guilty?
Before they could prove, they're just now going to look at me because of my brother, things that my dad said. So now they came after me. And it probably was until like 2 days later, I come home from work. And even when I'm at work, I worked at a paint shop. I'm seeing these cars, and if anybody's going to know an unmarked car, is me.
Yeah.
Right? I'm like, these look like undercover cops. And I already know that they're, when are they going to get me? So I'm just trying to live all I can remember is the attorney that I had says, as long as you don't say anything, they don't have anything on you. Don't talk. So you're fine. They might want to ask you, but just say, talk to my attorney. And you're fine. Don't tell anybody. Don't talk about this anymore. And you are fine. But when I saw the newspaper thing, and I'm at work, and I'm like, what's this cop car? Like at the driveway at the entrance off of Market. I get home. I down at the couch. And I'm still kind of like in a daze because when I'm walking home, because I live close by the shop, I see another cop car. Mm. And I'm like, and I'm looking around like, they're, where are they at? Because I don't see any bodies. I know that's a cop car because the hubcaps, the tires, I just know. I go in, I'm sitting on the couch. Next thing I hear is the crunch. I already knew the hard shoes. You know when hard shoes, the dress shoes, make that crunch on,
yep,
on like cement? And I could see two suits while the pant, the legs down. I already knew. So I go to the door. They ask me to have a seat. Cop sits here. My wife's here. The other one's standing. My kids are there. And they go, Mr. Roscoe, we have a warrant for first degree murder, blah, blah, this. Will you please stand up? We're placing you under arrest.
Your kids heard that?
Well, this is the crazy thing is my son at the time was a year and a half. He could even barely talk. And I'll never forget this, but for whatever reason, he just belted out in this horrible cry. Like, it was a different cry. It wasn't like I didn't get what he just belted out. This cry was primal, like the way he was screaming, because they, you know, they put the handcuffs on me and they took me away. And that was June 2nd, 1986.
It's like he's 1 year old and his body knew.
His body knew, that's like crazy. His spirit knew. And I don't know how much time, if you want to end up with me getting arrested and then the prison thing, or how you want to do this.
Let's get you in prison for the story's sake, and then we'll pause and have the redemption story come soon. All right. There's a full story. It's a happy ending, right?
Yeah, it is.
So,
yeah, so I end up getting arrested. I go to the county jail, and that was just so different from me because I was, now I'm confined, and I know that it's serious. And kind of remember I was telling you that the first time I ended up in county jail was at Elmwood, and you're free. Like, you're in Levi's and you could walk around, you're in barracks. Then you could leave. Like, then I left to get PSP. But I knew this time it wasn't, because I was put in red. When you're dressed in red, that's max, because you got a hot crime.
And it's like orange or red?
Yeah. It's defined on the top, the clothing you wear. It's just a simple shirt, like red. You have red, or like, yeah, orange is different. I forgot about the orange. It's like GP populate, general. Most guides for drugs.
Lame crimes.
But, you know, lame crimes. But when you have a violent crime or escape or something, and then if you're protective custody, let's say you have a crime that the inmates will retaliate you, then you have brown pants because you have gray pants. Gray, if you have gray and red, you're like considered, you're hot, but your general population, the cops don't need to protect you because you might get assaulted. So I was that because at the time I was playing like I, because at the time when I testified, I was being a snitch. Not really, but was. You know, because like I said, I was playing that dumb part, like it could be him. Instead of me saying, no, it wasn't him, I was like, I don't know. I can't say for sure, because that's what I'm thinking is fine. So, you know, I do the same thing. Preliminary hearing. My brother, this is where there's some contention, but it is what it is. My brother's telling me, oh, yeah, my brother just said he met this girl at a bar and he killed her. That was it. My dad's saying that, the preliminary hearing. Then, of course, we get the trial. And then my brother starts like, yeah, he was in the back of the car and he strangled her in the back. And none of that happened. Then my dad tells this crazy story. And my attorney is looking at me and he goes, why the fuck didn't you tell me this?
That day.
I told you to be truthful. See, attorneys don't like to get surprised. They want the truth from you, so they expect something. And I told my attorney, I go, I did not. Because they already have, like, remember I tried the discovery? So they already know what questions to ask, where the story's going.
Yeah.
But then if all of a sudden my dad makes up this whole other conversation, because they'll ask you, what conversations did you have with these people? So you tell them, okay, this is all we spoke about. this is all we spoke about. It's all that I told them. But then when they say something, they're going to be like, oh, it's either he's lying, somebody's lying. Or some, you know what I'm saying? Somebody who, either you told them and you're telling them you didn't. But at the end, I was arrested for first degree murder, which is bad. That's a 25 to life sentence. I was convicted on a second degree murder, which is what they call the heat of passion. See, first degree deals with more, you have enough time to decide not to. Like there's a window. Like if somebody offends, there's a thing like, you know, because somebody might get a thought of, I want to kill that person. Then there's enough time to talk yourself out of it. Yeah, there's anger. But with my conviction, it was a heat of passion. Like it just happened. Like I, you know, it was just one of those fast things that happened. So from that, I was sentenced, saw my kids for the pretty much the last time till they grew up as adults. Mm. It was kind of interesting that came to fruition about my mom. To remember I told you, my mom, if you go and you come back, Darlene will never let you see the kids. Well, that came true. I didn't see my youngest daughter till she was 20. Mm. She came to visit me in the prison. Mm. So I got to...
Because she was old enough to do it on her
own?
Yeah,
she was old enough to do it on her own. And basically what happened, because this other guy, Tom Snyder, was involved, and they were piecing things together because Darlene's parents were helping her out. Now that I'm in jail, gave her the ultimatum that if you go see Anthony, we won't help you out, because if he cares about his family, he'll testify against Tom Snyder. But they didn't know the whole case. I would be lying, or they didn't understand what was going on and what I was saying, because it was coming out in the newspapers. Because there was like 7 articles in the newspaper about the thing, and when I got arrested and this and that. So there was, and so everybody was kind of putting pieces together through the newspaper, and kind of what they heard here, kind of what they heard there. So I was convicted April 87 and went to Vacaville prison. It had to have been maybe May of 87. What there was reception. Reception is where they kind of decide what prison you're going to go to, because the thing about prison, they just can't put you anywhere. Because if you know about the street life, there's gangs, mm-hmm. right? There's like 2 biggest gangs, like say Chicano gangs or Nuestra Familia and the M.A. They're not necessarily set trip on where you're from. They kind of recruit whoever they can. But then you have under that, you have Norteños, Sureños, and the break line usually was considered Fresno. Like if you Fresno, somewhere in Fresno, I don't know where that line exists, but it's only with Chicanos, I should say, that there's a line somewhere that splits California to say, okay, you're a Norteño, and I'm a Sureño or Southsider. They call sometimes Sureño Southsiders for whatever reason. And so they decide where they're going to put you at. And they ended up putting me at Folsom Prison, Old Folsom, which is very dungeonous. It's old granite rock.
And you spent your time there?
And I started my time there. I went there. It was the scariest thing because the noise, the hollering, and quick thing was when I was at Vacaville and I came back from the counselor, and the counselor said, oh, we're going to be sending you to Folsom. When I came back to the dorm, I told the guys, hey, oh man, they're sending you. That's the enemy line, dude. You're going to kill you there. They don't say that's a Sureño line. You can't go there. If you go there, you're going to have to get off the minute they crack that cell. So they want to give me a piece, a shank. And I'm like, well, I'm not going to do it, but how would I get it up there? You got to keister it, meaning up the butt. And I'm like, I'm not doing nothing like that. I'm just going to try to see what I could do. And I ended up at Folsom Prison. I was only there at that time for 6 months because they put me in with the Sureño from San Diego, and they tend to put fear in you, you know, because I'm new to the system. I'm new to prison. I didn't grow up in that. So they have what I learned, a way of talking to you in the third person. And you think, oh, what do you mean the third person? Well, because of extortion laws and certain laws that they have with the gangs, you can't threaten anybody. Like, you can't say, you better do this or this is going to happen. What they do is they'll say, yeah, you know, that guy, he was in this cell and homeboy asked him to take a shank to the yard and he didn't do it and they moved on him. So he's telling a story. So he's planting that fear in you. Like, one of the ones he told me is when my dad got approved to visit, he told me a story. It was interesting. Now I remember that.
This might be the last one because the camera's going to die.
Okay. He told me the story about this guy's girlfriend that they asked him to get her to take money out. Because believe it or not, prison has money. Like, regular cash money. Maybe they hide it. They do stuff like that, but there's also an exchange that way. Not just your traditional Camel filter cigarettes and canteen. There's other ways to exchange money while you're buying stuff. Wow. Like drugs and things like that. So he told me that story and he knew that my dad was approved. So he was like, hey, you know, you ought to think if you want to make money to have a, think your dad will take out some money for us? And that's so illegal. One, it's illegal to have money in the prison, let alone have my dad take it out and break the law. So that was like one of my first
tests.
And then there was another test, and we could talk later about the weapon, because I caught a weapon stock beef when they said we were going to war with the blacks. And
so you have to learn a whole new philosophy.
Oh, my God.
You attain a whole new lifestyle in this prison.
All you do is, like, when I was in the county jail, when they put me on that tier, there was this guy called Monstro, meaning monster. He was from down south. He was the enemy because he's up here in the county jail. And he was telling me, he had the big brocha and tacked down, walking always crazy. And he says, hey, you know, when you get to the Pinta's prison, he goes, you're going to have to go with some credentials, eh? You know, you're going to have to, like, represent credentials. Because if you don't go, they're going to move on you and punk you. Like, I had to do stuff, right? Like, join the gang. So it's always, again, this weird life. And when you're up north, if you're a norteño, you got to know about your allies with the blacks or the BGF, Black Guerrilla Family, or the Crips or Bloods. They tell you when you get to prison, if you don't know what Chicano or Mexican to get to, find a black, because he'll tell you who's who. Wow. Right? Because what they'll do is, like me, I wasn't a gang member, but what they'll try to do is see if you are, you know. So
So you'll be open to going into, like, that whole experience and even what you're going into, the different groups.
Yeah.
Well, Tony, thank you so much for giving this first part. I think you're so amazing and your story's wild, and I want to pick your brain even more and just give another whole story and experience for our next episode. But I want to make sure everything's ready to go. So
yeah.
Anything you wanted to finish with, because this is going to be its own podcast. So any last words?
My whole thing is just giving back that the sorrow that I took somebody's life that I had absolutely no right to take somebody's life. But I didn't know that I was going to kill somebody in this life of drugs that I led. I just thought I was committing these little crimes that I just minimized, because I realized that in my recovery, I minimized a lot. And if I could share something that to give back, because I know where my victim lays. I've been to her plot and I haven't been there in a long time, but it's just something that I hope that whatever I could do is just my amends and restitution and giving back for a life that I'll never be able to pay back. But if I could just one person discourage that they're going to commit that crime that might end up in somebody's life being taken. That's all that means to me, that just to stop you, because anybody could take a life depending on the circumstance, the anger, the situation, who's pumping you, who's pushing your triggers, whatever it may be, inciting you, influencing you, trying to talk to doing something destructive, breaking a law or crime or hurt somebody. But it doesn't end well. You do not want to take somebody's life. Yeah. You just don't.
Hmm. We're going to leave that right there on a cliffhanger, and we're going to get this next episode shooted soon so we can finish the redemption part of the story. All right. Thank you.